From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, a conversation with community activist and protest organizer Khalil Coleman. Then we explore the connection between racial inequality and the COVID-19 pandemic.
If we do not change the structured inequity in our society, then every pandemic that comes through, every flood, every hurricane, everything is going to continue to pound on the same people.
Plus, we hear from the co-curator of this year's Sculpture Milwaukee about how some of the work is reflective of what's going on today.
I feel very fortunate that our board was really committed to putting Sculpture Milwaukee on this year, despite all this, all of the problems that we've had. But we really do think that this is a year when public art can really be part of the discussion about what we're going through.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The recent protests and demonstrations for racial justice and police accountability are undoubtedly some of the defining moments of this era. For some, this summer was a breaking point. But for others, like Khalil Coleman, it was the next step of a movement that's been building for years. Coleman is a local community activist and protest organizer whose work has been crucial to demonstrations here in Milwaukee. He was profiled in an article for this month's Milwaukee Magazine alongside fellow protest leaders Frank Nitti and Vaughn Mays. Khalil Coleman joins Lake Effect Story Powers to talk about his work, this movement, and the future of these demonstrations.
So much has happened over this summer and even these last few weeks, so I feel like it's pretty important to ask this. How are you doing right now? How are you feeling?
I'm doing great, actually. Obviously, some ups and downs and things, you know, in terms of, you know, justice and whatnot. But as far as, you know, my mental, you know, my physical, my spiritual level, I am blessed. I'm doing great.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I know especially the last month or so has been really emotionally taxing for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Much of this movement has recently shifted to Kenosha, Wisconsin. How have you been involved in the protests there?
You know, we started off our first 3 days out there in Kenosha, you know, very intense environment, of course. You know, a lot of things happening. I believe it was our second or third day during the day of the shooting that occurred. And, you know, we was listening to the radars, the scanners and things of that nature. And, you know, just, you know, having a little intel with some of the groups that was interning to Kenosha. And, you know, we just started getting updates of, like, these white supremacist groups were coming in to attack peaceful protesters. You know, they was coming looking to harm individuals and things of that nature. You know, we've been protesting across Wisconsin over the past 100 days. You know, and I remember just kind of being down there and, you know, we ended up parking, you know, at a particular intersection. And, you know, probably not even within 2-3 hours of us being there, we got calls that our tires were slashed, that the police was looking to push protesters to a particular designated area, and they were going to step back and allow these white supremacist groups to, you know, something to the nature of, like, do what they do. So, you know, we was hearing all of this information, pretty much people calling us, telling us be careful down there, you know, you guys are being targeted, et cetera, et cetera. And when the shooting occurred, it actually occurred maybe about like 3 or 4 blocks from where we were from. So all of this stuff was going on at the same time of all of our tires being slashed, or at least over 13 vehicles, I believe, experienced tire slash. So not all of them per se, but so we were stuck in the middle of Kenosha with the city being on lockdown, a gas station was being closed, no tolls coming into the city to help anybody out. People were forced to drive their cars on flats out of Kenosha to a more safer county. So it's been extremely intense. you know, and knowing one of the individuals who was shot was a medic since day one of the protest in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You know, this is a guy who has put himself on the line multiple times when police were shooting people with rubber bullets, throwing tear gas during a time when real gunfire and things were being exchanged. These were individuals who were putting their selves on the line, running in the middle of chaos and pulling people to rescue, and to find out that, you know, this was one of the individuals who was a victim in this shooting. It was very emotional for people. So, so it's been crazy these last 100 days, to say the least.
Yeah, of course. Now, you've been involved with a lot of the behind-the-scenes work, making these demonstrations happen, making things flow more smoothly. What has that experience been like, especially since there's been so much that has happened, as you mentioned, over the last 100 days or so?
It's been humbling, you know, just to, you know, walk alongside with some of these individuals, you know, just phenomenal people, you know, educators, social workers, artists, you know, corporate people in high places and, you know, on the front line and behind the scenes who just support the work that the people in the revolution have been participating in and been able to make happen. It's just been a humbling experience. You know, for so many great people to come together into a line with a vision. And of course, you know, since day one and, you know, looking at 103 days, of course, the numbers aren't as strong. But I think the support from the community, you know, whether we go in Milwaukee, whether we go in Tulsa, it's still really heavy. You know, people want to see these demonstrations happen. People want to see law changes. People want to see a change in community culture, you know, where black and white and black and brown and white people can coexist, you know, in a community and not be treated unjust. So, you know, it has been a lot of work and a lot of people have really stepped up and have helped this revolution grow and progress over the 100 days.
Yeah, of course, you know, you're mentioning this is a movement that has not only been here in Milwaukee and also in Kenosha, but also in Wauwatosa. And a number of the members of your group actually went to D.C. What was that like? I know that you were back here in Milwaukee for this, but what was that experience like setting that up?
Yeah, you know, we have one of our core organizers, you know, Mariah Smith, pretty much leading the D.C. trip. You know, we were able to get sponsors. I believe about 30 so people, you know, went on the trip or so. And for a lot of them, it was their first time, you know, going to D.C., you know, being able to go to the White House, you know, especially with so much political tension going on right now with you know, evolving around presidency and just a lot of social issues right now. You know, it was a great experience to be able to have people stay back and keep the revolution alive and thriving for these 100 and something days and have people out there in D.C. keeping the message alive, bring it to the forefront, issues of Wisconsin, issues of Milwaukee. So it was just great to see the duo, you know, still continue to, you know, take these concerns and their experiences and expand them and have our people come back from D.C., you know, with more fire, more insight, and just a better understanding of how this thing connects on a national level. I think that was probably the most important part of the D.C. trip.
Yeah, to give it some of that national view. You know, as you've said, this is a movement that has led to some real change. When you look at the last months, what are the things that you're most proud of that you've been able to accomplish through this movement?
You know, on our 100th day, we finally released our demands. I think that was a really, really big accomplishment for us, you know, to be able to go through our first, you know, 99 days of experience, you know, really seeing what the issue were, really listening to the people in terms of their ability to be able to articulate what it is that needed to be done in the system, you know, and being able to have that pressure and that demand in the street while we're protesting, you know, shutting things down, making that impact, you know, to be able to supply these demands with that. You know, we also been able to get Joseph Mensah suspended, the police officer out in Wauwatosa who killed three individuals within a 5-year span. We was able to get the officer who killed Mattioli, who killed Joel Acevedo. You know, charges are pending against him in the strangulation of Joel. We were able to fire the chief from Milwaukee Police Department with the support of the Fire and Police Commission, just with their lack of transparency and urgency in regarding a lot of these matters, you know, and just a lack of leadership in regards to MPD, you know. So that was a big thing. You know, places like Cudahy, you know, introduced legislation such as racism is a public health crisis. You know, that was introduced out there in Cudahy. Legislation was introduced into the Common Council of Milwaukee, the I Can't Breathe legislation by Malele Cox. Not really sure where that's at in the legislation, but these are the type of things that are occurring because of the protests. You know, in Wauwatosa, we was able to ban no knock warrants and no chokeholds by any law enforcement within the district of Wauwatosa. You know, we established an ad hoc committee in Wauwatosa that pretty much takes these recommendations directly to the Common Council for voting purposes and decision making. So all of this has occurred within the first 100 days of protest. And it's been some great challenges, but some great success to go along with them.
Now, of course, the movement isn't over by any stretch of the imagination. I've heard that some people want to go for at least 200 days. What do you see as kind of the end of this movement? And I guess the other question is, do you see an end?
You know, I've been in a lot of protests throughout the years out here in Milwaukee. You know, I think my first jump was like the murder of Darius Simmons, who was killed in front of his house after John Spooner, the murderer of Darius Simmons, the 13-year-old boy. John Spooner spoke with Bob Donovan, former alderman. And pretty much Bob Donovan, I remember how the investigation went. Bob Donovan told him to do what he had to do. And John Spooner ended up going home after meeting with him, and he killed the 13-year-old boy in front of his parents. And that's really what sparked me and leading a lot of the protests out here in Milwaukee. And then it led to Derek Williams, who was murdered. They broke his neck bone and threw him in the backseat of a police car, and he suffocated. And I remember marching in the streets for a whole year for Derek Williams. And then we ended up connecting with Michael Bell, and, you know, we passed the bail law with the outside investigation with police officers. And then I remember Dontre Hamilton died, and for 4 months the family cried in the park with no answer from the mayor, from the chief. And then we ended up leading the Dontre Hamilton rallies, and, you know, now here we are. And I remember taking a break after that, and then kind of seeing all of the other stuff transpiring around the country. You know, hearing about George Floyd just recently, and it just opened up a lot of wounds. And, you know, to kind of answer your question about like this, and I think all of it kind of builds up one addition on top of the other. The evolution of each one of these things occurring, you know, is what continues to build on what the next phase look like. So, you know, whether we're done, and I don't think that 200 days is like our goal of like being done, you know, that kind of came out of us marching on a regular, and then, you know, us learning a little history about the Milwaukee housing marches and learning that they marched for 200 days. And then it became a thing like, okay, you know, for revolution, like, you know, we can do this. And a lot of people just kind of like want to see us, you know, make that history. But I don't think that's the goal of the end of the protest. I think people really want to see laws change. We really want to see police be held accountable, you know, when they break the law, when they break policies and procedures, to not allow them to be on paid relief, right? You know, to allow police officers to go through due process. Like, if I kill, I'm going to court. You know what I'm saying? I got to face my jury. Police officers should do the same thing. You know, when they murder, it shouldn't be exempt investigations. You know, and I think that's what people want to see. People want to see police officers be judged by a jury or their peers, just like every other person would too.
Yeah. So as you look to the future, what are your biggest priorities in at least the immediate future? What do you want to see happen?
You know, in the immediate future, you know, we want to see, of course, Joseph Vincent fired. You know, he shouldn't be a police officer. You know, I mean, you know, we feel there's like some real, just some real issues for one cop to kill three people within a 5-year span, right? And if he follows every policy, then that's a problem too. Because if I kill three people within 5 years and this is a policy for policing for me to do, I think all of these things are questionable right now, right? Is it the individual or is it the system that needs to be held accountable? And in some cases, it's both, right? Because we have individuals who are acting as judge, jury, and executioners because they can, because the system allows them to. That's what I want to see, like me personally. You know, I want to see police officers go to jail, you know, when they break the law, you know, just like my brothers and my sisters would in my community. I want to see me and my children and my brothers and sisters in my community live where police officers are accountable to the community that they serve, you know, and when police officers break laws and policies and procedures, that they're held accountable in the community that they serve. That's what I want to see happen.
Khalil Coleman is a local community activist and protest organizer. Coleman was profiled in an article in this month's Milwaukee Magazine alongside fellow activists Frank Nitti and Vaughn Mays. You can find more information at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we hear from the keynote speaker of this year's Minority Health Film Festival. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The second annual Minority Health Film Festival kicked off in Milwaukee this week. Now through September 24th, 50 films, events, and discussions will highlight how institutions and communities impact the health of marginalized groups. Of course, due to COVID-19, this festival will be virtual, with the exception of some drive-in events. Dr. Kamara Jones is a family physician and epidemiologist whose work focuses on naming, measuring, and addressing the impacts of racism on the health and well-being of people, and she gave the keynote speech for this year's festival. Jones joined WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell to discuss why people of color are bearing the brunt of the COVID-19 virus and how the nation can begin to work toward health equity.
Black and brown and indigenous folks are overrepresented among those who are infected and then overrepresented among those who are dying from COVID-19 is not because we are more susceptible. We are no more susceptible to this virus than anybody else. At the beginning in 2019, December, there was no human on this planet who was immune to this virus. What we are is we're more likely to get infected because we're more exposed and less protected. And then once infected, we're more likely to die because we're more burdened by chronic diseases with less access to health care. Now, each of those things, more exposed, why are we more exposed? Well, first of all, we're more likely to be in those poorly paid frontline jobs, you know, grocery clerks, bus drivers, you know, mail delivery people, warehouse workers, in the meat packing plants, poultry packing plants. And why are we more likely to be in those frontline jobs? It's because when the federal government solidified racially segregated communities in this country, I mean, that's been the case over centuries, but especially in the 20th century, where the VA and the FHA and all of these federal agencies solidified racially segregated communities and then disinvested in those communities. Now you have poor communities, and when the schools are supported by local property tax and you have poorly funded schools, which turns into poor educational outcomes and often, and another generation lost, and then those poorly educated people, what job opportunities do they have? So it's directly out of that line. So that's racism in one thing. Then why are we less protected, right? Well, even though we're essential workers in these jobs, we're not highly valued. We're not valued in our pay. We're not valued in personal protective equipment, not valued with hazard pay or, you know, family and medical leave. You know, so we're less protected in terms of on the job or even being able to stay away from the job when the job is hazardous. Then why are we more burdened by chronic diseases? It has the same thing to do with the disinvestment and crowding into communities where you have environmental hazards, no access or limited access to green space, crowded housing, public transportation, if you can get it, you know, no access to healthy foods or very limited at high price access to healthy foods. All of these things, all of these adverse neighborhood conditions, which are not even provoking action, and very often racism, especially structural racism, shows up as inaction in the face of need. So that's making us sicker. That's giving us more of the diabetes, more of the high blood pressure, more of the kidney disease, the asthma, and all of those things that once you get infected with the virus are going to cause you to have a worse outcome. And then what about the healthcare system? So everything I've said so far has nothing to do with healthcare. It has to do with the conditions of our lives. But then even in terms of the healthcare, first of all, especially early on in the pandemic, Black folks were showing up at hospitals to be evaluated and sent home to die without even getting a temperature taken or a COVID-19 test. The testing centers were located in affluent areas, and especially at the beginning, they were drive up. What if you don't have a car? Requiring a doctor's, you know, order. What if you don't have ready access to a primary care doctor? So all of that. And even once you get in the hospital, these criteria that hospitals are drawing up to govern how they're going to deal with the situation if they have one ventilator left and 10 people who need it, these crisis standards of care are baking into the criteria of who is going to get that last ventilator, whether or not you have kidney disease, whether or not you have diabetes, and putting people who have those conditions at lower chance of getting the life-saving equipment that they need, the therapies that they might need. And so that's baking in the structural racism that's already in our bodies, baking it into that how we're going to care for folks.
I like the way you broke down that there are really levels to the disadvantages that are stacked against Black, Indigenous, and other people of color, from the divestment in our communities to the lack of transportation, the jobs that we work, each really continuing to impact our health. And people who don't have a reason to pay attention to these types of issues likely aren't aware of how extensive the problem is.
Many people who don't live in those neighborhoods, never even go through those neighborhoods, don't even understand the conditions in those neighborhoods, and really don't understand that there are people living in those neighborhoods who are just as kind, funny, generous, hardworking, smart as they are, but living in very different circumstances. And there are people in this country who blame folks who are trapped in some of these disinvested neighborhoods, blame them as being lazy or stupid. If they just worked harder, they would be able to get out.
Exactly.
So I just want to share that there are 7 different things that characterize how we look at one another in this country. I am now calling these values targets that are making the government and many people who are better off or, you know, in power blind to the conditions that are not only causing folks to be more affected by COVID-19, but God forbid we have COVID-21. If we don't change these conditions or you know, H1N1 24, I mean, we as a world are getting so close to the so-called natural environment, and there are going to be so many more crossovers of animal diseases to humans. And if we do not change the structured inequity in our societies, then every pandemic that comes through, every flood, every hurricane, everything is going to continue to pound on the same people. We need to value all of us equally. We need to recognize and rectify historical injustices, and we need to provide resources according to need. Those are actually three principles for achieving health equity that I have distilled.
I'm actually glad you brought up those three principles for achieving health equity, because I was going to bring them up. I saw them in an article that you wrote for Newsweek back in April of this year. Summarize what you mean by each of those principles and how we might see them in practice in the healthcare system.
Well, when you value all individuals and populations equally, first of all, you're going to make sure that if you value folks, you're going to have their voice at decision-making tables, right? When you're trying to figure out something that pertains to them. So it means reaching out to communities and all kinds of folks. If you're trying to figure out what are we going to do about the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on Black and brown communities, you need to bring Black and brown community voices to those decision-making mm-hmm. tables. They could give you a lot of insight about what we need to be doing, right? So often people at decision-making tables think they have all the knowledge and expertise and perspective that they need, and they don't reach out to the communities that are being affected.
Right.
For that second principle, recognizing and rectifying historical injustices, first of all, what it means is that each of us needs to know, first of all, our full U.S. history, and so many of our textbooks don't have our full histories. They might have one or two paragraphs about, the enslaved Africans and African descendants, and depict them as happy or whatever. Even these days, there is an attempt to say that we cannot teach about or talk about the 401 years now of the presence of Africans brought to this country in chains, enslaved, as very well written in the 1619 Project of the New York Times. There's been pushback by some people to say that we can't look at that. So we have to know our full history. Then we should each know the history of the neighborhood we're in, the city we're in. And if you are a decision maker, you need to, if you're trying to untie a knot, if you have a thorny problem that you're trying to solve, wouldn't it behoove you? Wouldn't it be good for you to know how that knot was tied, to look at the history of how if you're trying to do something about housing in such and such a neighborhood, well, how did the housing get like that? When did the highway come through? What was up with that? Who was, forcefully removed by eminent domain, and who was not paid or not relocated? So we need to understand history. We need to, first of all, recognize and then rectify historical injustices. And then how do we provide resources according to need? Now, the first thing is to recognize that I didn't say provide resources equally. There's a difference between equality and equity. Equity is when you provide people with what they need.
Dr. Jones, you say your work is really helping people to name, measure, and address racism. And it just made me think about Milwaukee County declaring racism a public health crisis. If you were working with Milwaukee County officials, what would you say to them about how to keep that conversation going and turn it into action? Because, of course, it's not enough to just declare racism this crisis. I mean, it's great to declare that, right? That's the first step. But how do we turn that declaration into action?
So first of all, I have to congratulate Milwaukee County for being the first to make that formal declaration of racism as a public health crisis in May of 2019. So that's more than a year ago. And what would I say to Milwaukee County now? I say you need to make sure that you're not just running things by the community in terms of what you're planning to do or this, but that you are asking the community to help you develop an agenda, that you are in solid partnership with that every committee that you have, every county agency and all, that you have very, very strong mechanisms for sustained community input. So that's the first thing, that this is a partnership, because a declaration is one thing. You're saying, okay, Milwaukee, hold us accountable. We've declared racism to be a public health crisis. We've said the word, now hold us accountable. But to really be accountable, you have to be in partnership with people and you have to be willing to listen. So that's the first thing. That's the valuing all individuals and populations equally. That's how it would be manifest there. You also have to be willing to invest deeply in communities that have been historically disinvested. So you need to actually put more resources in communities. You need to clean up environmental hazards. There should be nobody living in what the Environmental Protection Agency would call sacrifice zone. That's a real thing. They call some communities sacrifice zones because they are right next to known polluting industries. You should be putting, you should be investing in Black business. So the partner, you know, in terms of who does the work, you need to be investing in Black schools. Now, I know that there's no such thing as a Black school because, you know, it's all public schools or whatever. But there are, because we look at, you know, the racial segregation in our neighborhoods, which turns into racial segregation in our schools. We need to be investing, enriching the poor rocky soil of some communities until it's as rich as the richest fertile soil in other communities in the area, right? And so that's when you're talking about recognizing and rectifying historical injustices. The third thing you have to do is to, and I guess I just said it in terms of recognizing and rectifying, that providing resources according to need. The resources could be early childhood education. The resources could be better public transportation to all parts of everywhere. Of the three principles I gave, when you provide resources according to need, then that is a way of recognizing and rectifying historical injustices. And it, in recognizing and rectifying historical injustices, that is a way of valuing all individuals and populations equally. So if I had to pick one of those principles to guide how you go forward, look at the need in the area. Just document the need. I'm sure it's already in all kinds of tables and graphs everywhere. And then provide resources according to need, which might mean that some folks go a year, 2 years, maybe a decade without additional resources until you bring the other folks up. This is not just giving a little bit of something on the top. We're not trying to ice this cake. There's a huge hole in the cake, and we need to fill that up first before we can put some icing on top.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by the Doman Company Foundation.
Dr. Kamara Jones is an epidemiologist and an expert in the connection between race and health. She was the keynote speaker for Milwaukee Film's Minority Health Film Festival, and she spoke with WUWM's Race and Ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell. We'll take one more break and then hear from the co-curator of this year's Sculpture Milwaukee. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There's at least one Milwaukee attraction that never had to close during the coronavirus pandemic. Sculpture Milwaukee is a nonprofit organization responsible for filling downtown Milwaukee with outdoor art. The current exhibit will be on display for the next year. Sculpture Milwaukee has created one of the most robust collections of contemporary public art in the country. Mary Lou Knode is the Director of Curatorial Affairs and Education at Sculpture Milwaukee and a co-curator. She's been involved in the arts community for more than 30 years, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about the current exhibit.
How has Sculpture Milwaukee adapted to the pandemic and the protests and just a different year than really anyone expected?
Well, I will just say that the curatorial team has been working on the exhibition this year since last summer. So the minute every show opens, you're on. You keep moving forward to think about what might be relevant for this year. There's no doubt about the fact that when the pandemic hit and the economic climate for fundraising changed, we had really hoped to program up by about 30% more artworks because of the DNC and the incredible visibility of the city. But we had to really reduce things quite a bit for the reality of everything. We also had to delay our installation period because a lot of the work that we get is in New York, some in Los Angeles, and some in the UK this year, and quite a few works from Chicago. But, you know, if galleries close and the shippers are not working, there's nothing we can do. We do not have our hands on the artworks that we borrow from other people, from both galleries and artists. So we were delayed quite a bit. You know, getting the works out of the UK was tricky because we had a window of opportunity that kept moving. And it's funny because in January I was working on borrowing a work that by a British artist that was in China. And that window closed much sooner than anything else. So I have to say that I had a foretaste of what we were going to be going through with that particular work that we were not able to borrow because the museum was shut down by the time we needed to get it going. So in any case, we have a very nimble team of about 100 people, over 100 people, shippers, riggers, marketing folks, the curators, the team for fundraising, our board, our volunteers. So everybody has just been sort of reacting to the reality of our world. However, we are already physically distanced with what we do. You know, work is outside. And so we really are hoping that people who need just something to take their minds off of or to embed how artists reflect your world back to you. Sculpture Milwaukee is a really great chance to just get outside, get some exercise, maybe see other people, because I know that that's a really important thing for me right now. So, you know, I feel very fortunate that our board was really committed to putting Sculpture Milwaukee on this year, despite all this, you know, all of the problems that we've had. But we really do think that this is a year when public art can really be part of the discussion about what we're going through.
So tell me a little bit about this year's Sculpture Milwaukee.
So we have 19 artworks by 19 artists. Four of those artworks overwintered from last year. And I use that word on purpose because nobody really overwinters in Milwaukee. You either live here or you leave town for warmer climes. But, you know, we are really mindful of the fact that we like to keep the exhibition alive for people through the winter months. One of the impacts of COVID-19 is that many more of the works from this year's exhibition are going to be living through the winter into the spring and probably through 2021. And that's just a really great way for us to reflect the normal practice of our colleagues in museums where you have things up all year round. And it also gives people a chance to see the works in the fall and under snow, in the spring when the leaves change color, come back. So, you know, I feel like in many ways we've been able to adapt because you have a very inventive group of people that we're working with.
What are some of the artworks that really stood out to you in this year's Sculpture Milwaukee?
I love the piece. It's deeply meaningful to me because of the layers of work. Layers of meaning that he brings to us. The art history references I always appreciate because it allows me to activate, you know, my medieval art history class with Marilyn Stockstead, and just to think about, you know, how do we look into the past and what the Greeks did to help us understand Western art history. Thomas Price is hacking into that art history by using the formal qualities of sculpture, but presenting a very, very timely bit of content to it. And that really changes how we look at art history. And I really appreciate that. I really love the Blob Monster. I find a great deal of meaning in Neri Ward's piece, Apollo Pole. You know, the Apollo Theater is certainly very important. Isabel Wilkerson, in her book, A Warmth of Other Suns, talked about the Great Black Migration, and the Apollo Theater was part of that, where artists, you know, performing artists of color could present their work to their audiences and create a really very vibrant place for, you know, theater, music, singers, etc. The fact that he has the sign flipped between Apollo and Pole is very current, where, you know, access to voting is really very much compromised, not just by voter ID laws, but by the pandemic. So again, that work had meaning a year ago when I asked to borrow the work for Sculpture Milwaukee, but it's extremely meaningful for us today. Now, we put that piece at the Wisconsin Center District, which was to be the corner of where the DNC was held. I do know that some of my colleagues across the country saw it in some of the coverage, but it wasn't nearly the kind of sort of vibrant beacon that we had hoped for. I think it still has a great deal of resonance for us. We are looking to work with some folks to do voter registration at the Apollo poll. The problem being there are very few people downtown right now. So I don't know, it's going to be hard for us to register a lot of people to vote downtown. But we just really want to support people in our community who are already doing that kind of voter registration. And then Leslie Hewitt is another artist of color whose work is about the importance of Black-owned bookstores and their disappearance for various reasons. I think the Paula Crown piece in the Third Ward, her work is talking partially about party culture and, you know, the red Solo cups that you see in the garbage, you know, in the sewers after a party weekend. But it's also about the scourge of single-use plastic. And as one of the cities that stewards one of our Great Lakes, we have to really be mindful of how that impacts us as, you know, Milwaukeeans, but also what that means for human survival. So there are all kinds of stories that are told through all of the works. Even a work like Anna Fasshauer's piece that looks like a bunch of blue straws kind of crumpled up. She's really addressing sort of the extreme macho minimalism of the 1960s and 70s and how women have for a very long time sort of attacked it by adapting some of the vocabulary, but really twisting it. So it's a very playful piece. It looks a little bit wacky, like some kid threw its, you know, her straw down, but it's very playful, but also has some real deep meaning to it.
What challenges and opportunities has the pandemic presented for Sculpture Milwaukee?
Well, I would say that we've been very nimble in making lemonade out of lemons. So the fact that we have responded to this problem by having works over winter, but really in a deliberate way, so that the exhibition really does last for a year. I think that's a really great way in which we have, kept the works here for public discussion. I think that one particular change I've made this year is that in my audio scripts, often I invite a lot of community members to talk about a work that maybe intersects with what they do for a living. So, for example, last year we had a Red Grooms hot dog vendor, and I asked Alexa Alfaro, who co-runs Meat on the Street food truck with her brother, and Alexa talked about what is it like to be a food vendor in a truck? You know, what kind of community do you have in your window? You know, your little window that sort of, you see your face and they see yours and you see theirs. There's something very playful about that. This year, I actually asked the artists to talk about their own work, and most of them responded positively. And so you're actually hearing the artists talk about some of their primary motivations for making their work. Another thing that I did this year in recognition of our isolation is I've started a reading group, and I've asked the artists what books were particularly inspiring to them for the works that we have on view. And so, for example, Neri Ward sent me a reference to a children's book about the Voting Rights Act so that parents can get that book for their kids and talk about issues that maybe helped inform Neri in his thinking about Apollo Poll. So I'm planning on us doing some reading and some book reports over the winter, and I think we'll reach out to some other community members to see if, you know, they want to tackle one of the books that the artists have represented. So lots of reading for the winter when we're all shut back inside. So if anybody is interested in a particular reading group, you know, as a curator, when I go to artist studios, I often come away with a list of about four books, and it's sometimes overwhelming. So at least I'm sharing this with everybody else, and you can get a sense about how artists really think deeply. I think the cliche is that artists just sort of toss things off. It's not at all true. That's a tough thing to do. And I don't think we would be showing that work if that was as shallow as your, you know, kind of engagement would be. There's all kinds of work that artists make, and I hope we've presented works that are stimulating for all the different ways in which we live as humans. You know, there are things that are fun and playful. There are things that are really pretty straightforward and help us mourn the things that are happening in our society.
To your knowledge, has there been a change in how many people are going to see and interacting with the exhibits this year?
Well, that's always a tough thing for a public art program because we don't have docents standing next to each work and clicking who walks by it. We have used sort of a balanced way to figure out how many people may have engaged with the show. There are the statistics that Visit Milwaukee has about how many people have visited Milwaukee. And we know people come downtown because that is where you see a lot of cultural organizations anyway, the Milwaukee Art Museum, all the theaters, et cetera. But, you know, because this year we were not able to have group tours working with the docents at the Milwaukee Art Museum, we don't have those statistics. But I'll continue to do tours for small groups. City Tours is doing tours for people who maybe don't want to walk along the avenue. So there's somebody who could actually take, who can take your family along Wisconsin Avenue and down into the Third Ward to see the works. We have a lot of partners who lead tours in the city. Historic Milwaukee intersects and overlaps with Sculpture Milwaukee, and we continue to sort of get their statistics. We have some educational partners who are using us to stimulate hands-on activities. But that's, you know, we really do think that because we're part of our entire community, maybe the entire community is part of our, you know, the people who enjoy what we do.
Are there sculptures in either this year or previous years that seem especially relevant right now?
So, you know, there have been a lot of topics that artists have explored over the last 4 years. You know, Richard Wood's work, which overwintered from last year, was dealing with the global housing crisis and access to affordable housing. He was thinking a little bit about the British habit of caravanning, but also all the refugee crisis that's happening in Europe. That seems to have real relevance to the United States right now because of the threat of eviction for a lot of folks who've lost their jobs. The importance of African and African diasporic beliefs and traditions in contemporary society have come up in many works. Shekiah Booker, Alison Saar, Sanford Biggers. The impact of immigration on the laws and traditions in this country, that was explored in some ways in the works of Radcliffe Bailey, Sky Hopinka, Carlos Rolón, Joan Capote. How architecture makes place, and there's a lot of works in the shows that have sort of pointed to how we form our cities and how we and our beliefs shape our reactions and interactions with place. The importance of protecting our landscape as climate changes, Roxy Payne, Carlos Rolón. So there are all these themes in every year that really sort of address things that may be really very acute this year.
How have artists you know and work with reacted to what's going on in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and across the country, really?
Well, I would say that artists are very smart people and they react to whatever environment they live in. So, for example, we have two British artists in the show and Thomas Price, we've talked about at length, but Julian Opie and his Natalie Walking is thinking about the homogenization of cities and we're losing a lot of what's really unique about place. And so by having this young woman walking in our downtown environment, you know, it's about how women have migrated into our economic centers. Are they leaders? Are they employees? You know, what role do women play in having an impact in our businesses? And there's a lot of writing about diversity of leadership of businesses makes them more sustainable and more nimble. And I wonder what we're going to be talking about it in a year, how women in leadership positions can help companies make it through this period. There's been a lot of writing about how a lot of countries' leaders that are women have helped their countries get through this pandemic. So I think we're gonna all be talking about what are those points of contact for what it is that we're thinking about. Paul Druka's work, which we brought back, was commissioned in 2017, but is incredibly relevant today. He's a Milwaukee-based artist who talks about the lake and how we gather around water places. You know, access to water is one of the most important things we need as humans, but it's also often the trigger for wars. So when you think about a lot of the conflict in the Middle East, it's because who has access to the source of water? The Nile is a very contested space. The Ottoman Empire was fighting to control water, fresh water, in the Middle East in the 19th century. So, you know, there are all these touchstones that I think we'll really reflect upon in the next year.
What are the changes you all are planning for next year? Or can you tell me a little bit about what you're looking forward to about the next show?
So I will continue to bring in a good group of guest curators to help expand sort of the artist base that we work with. That's always a lot of fun. And that's a pretty typical thing, too, in museum practice, to bring in people with different expertise. I look forward to us having the works up through the fall, winter, and spring, because the works really do change the way we see our downtown. And I think we'll continue to need opportunities and reasons to get out of our houses in the next 6 months.
Mary Lou Canode is the Director of Curatorial Affairs and Education at Sculpture Milwaukee. She helped to curate this year's display in downtown Milwaukee, and she spoke with LakeFX Becca Schimmel. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.